This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Good morning and welcome to K4HD Radio. This is the Your Living Brand Live show. My name is Ben Baker. This show is all about how you communicate value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Over the next 50 minutes, we will explore different ways to help you demonstrate your uniqueness and ask our guest, what's your story? Welcome to the show. Hi, everybody. It's Ben Baker. It's the Your Living Brand Live show. It's September 11th, 2019. I can't believe it's been 18 years since that fateful day. I remember it as if it was yesterday. Anybody who's a certain age remembers that date, just like everybody remembers where they were when Kennedy was shot. It changed lives, and it's changed our world forever. I remember exactly where I was. I was at a press. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. I was on the west coast of Canada, and I was waiting for press proofs to come off the press so I could get in my car and drive the 3 hours down to Seattle to visit a client and show them the sheets before we printed their run. And as I waited for the press to warm up, and as I waited for the first sheets to come off the press, somebody had a radio on. Within 5 minutes, the press had stopped, the radio was turned up loud, and somebody was running looking for a small television. And we sat there, and we watched, and we watched. And we saw the second plane hit the tower, and no one could believe what happened. It was an incredible day. And what I realized is our world has changed. Somewhat for the better, a lot of it for the worse. But it's up to us to decide where we go from there. We all need to realize that there are defining moments in our life. There's things that will change us forever. And the question is, what do we learn from them? How do we pick up and move on? How do we take periods of our life that could be absolutely traumatic, that change us forever, and learn lessons to make us better people? And that's what we really need to think about. What can we do as individuals, as companies, as leaders of organizations to look at failure, to look at tragedy, to look at hardship, and sit there and think, what can we do better next time? What can we learn from this? What are the things that we could have done that could have made it easier, not only for us, but for our customers, our employees, everyone? Because you know what? There will be tragedy. There will be hardship. Things will go wrong in our lives. That's a natural. Things are going to happen. The real true leaders, the people that will survive, the people that will thrive in this world, take that hardship and evaluate and look at things and sit there and say, okay, what's next? What are the things that we can do to take us from this situation and make things better? And make things better not only in the short run, but in the long run as well. What are the systems that we can change? What are the things we can do? What are the processes we can come up with? What are the relationships we can build that will make not only us stronger, but our customers stronger, the people we care about stronger, our employees stronger, and be able to make our lives better in the long run? We need to think about that. Tragedy happens. There's nothing we can do about it. You know, people get hit by trains. Airplanes can fly into buildings. You know what? Tragedy happens. The question is, what do you do now? If you sit there and you worry about it and you lament and you say, what comes next? What happened? You know, what's the next tragedy that's going to happen? We become paralyzed. And none of us are at our best when we're paralyzed. when we're constantly worried about what's the other shoe that's going to drop, what's the next thing that can go wrong, we can't focus on what can go right. And trust me, there is way more in life that goes right than goes wrong. And we need to think that way. We need to stop thinking about glasses being half full. We need to stop thinking about glasses being half empty. We need to start thinking about glasses that are refillable, that we can change the past, the future. We can learn from the past. We can change the present and change our future based on attitude, based on looking at things a different way and sitting there going, okay, how do we move forward differently? Because if we keep doing what we've always done and we keep thinking the same way that we've always thought, nothing will ever get better. Nothing will ever change, and people will continue to do what they do day in and day out, and the problems that we have will get worse. But if we sit there and say, all right, this happened, we made a mistake, we had something go wrong, something went the way that we didn't want it to happen, what can we learn from this? What can we do better? How can we move forward? How can we make things better? Now, let's take a second. Let's think about that. Let's go out for commercial. And I've got a real treat for you. Rabbi Jessica Marshall is coming, and she and I are going to be having a great conversation. And I know she will inspire. This is Ben Baker of the You're Living Brand.live show on K4HD Radio. We'll be right back.
The Your Living Brand Show is brought to you by Your Brand Marketing. Did you know that the world views your brand not as you desire, but as it relates to them? That's why you need to communicate your brand. Tell a story. Win loyalty. Your Brand Marketing helps you reach that goal. It's time to stop being a commodity and instead be a brand worth loving. It's time to contact Your Brand Marketing. Please visit www.powerfulpersonalbrands.com. Download a free chapter of the book on personal branding. That's www.powerfulpersonalbrands.com. Download your free copy now.
Welcome back to K4HD Radio. This is Ben Baker, and this is the Your Living Brand Live Show. Welcome back. I couldn't think of another person I wanted to have on the show on September 11th other than Rabbi Jessica Marshall. Rabbi Marshall is one of the most positive people I know. She's incredible. She is a wedding officiant. She does couples retreat. She's been a full-time pulpit rabbi. And she really is the type of person that knows how to help people get through tragedy and see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I thought that she would be the greatest person to be on the show. So without further ado, hello, Jessica. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thank you, Ben. It's so wonderful to join you. I'm really wonderful.
Well, it's finally nice to actually meet you because, you know, you and I have done LinkedIn back and forth, but, you know, we've actually never talked. So it's nice to actually have you on the show and have the conversation. So thanks for taking the time today. You know, it's 9/11. It is, you know, September 11th. It is the 18th anniversary of September 11th. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into that. But I want to start off the show because for people who don't know, this show is about how do people add value? How do you communicate the value? How do you tell your story in a way that people want to care about it, that it resonates with them, that they see the value in you, and they want to be with you, and they want to explore the type of things that you can offer and how you help them. So let's get into this. You know, it's Rabbi Jessica Marshall. Is it, you know, let's talk about it because, you know, I've got a member of the clergy. I need to have your wisdom. Your wisdom today.
Oh, thanks, Ben. Yeah, and thank you for mentioning this tragic anniversary too. I think it still feels incredibly relevant and a call, you know, to action and to a continued commitment for connecting and coming from a place of love over fear. So thank you for mentioning that.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay. A little bit about my story. Well, I think I'm going to start by telling a story, and that is how I decided I wanted to become a rabbi.
Love it.
Okay. So I was a 21-year-old. I was living in Washington, D.C. I had a summer internship like many college kids. And it was a Friday afternoon, and I decided that I wanted to go to Sabbath services, to Shabbat services.
Right.
So these were the days of us still having phone books. You may remember those
3-inch thick, you know, things that you sit there and you go, okay, this has got a lot of weight to it. What do I do with it? Okay.
Right, exactly. So I look up synagogues in the phone book, and I found one, and I got out of work, and I was running late, like running down the street after the bus, you know, searching for money in my purse, got to the synagogue, and everyone was standing in the foyer, and the cantor, who's the person who plays music at services, was playing a song on the guitar, and I just felt like, oh, there's no place I'd rather be. It felt so right. And everyone was incredibly warm and welcoming, and that's what really stood out to me. I just felt, I felt encircled. And as I was walking in the doors to the sanctuary, there was kind of an older couple next to me, and I introduced myself, and they said, oh, are you here alone? And I said, yes. And they said, come sit with us.
Nice.
And yeah, it was lovely. And it got even better because instead of putting me next to them, which is what most people would do, they had me sit in between them. So I was in between this couple feeling incredibly like enveloped and cared for. And during that service, the rabbi did two things. First he did a baby naming, and then he blessed a couple on their 58th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah. And the couple was so adorable. The man was like probably 4 feet, 5 inches tall, little white haired, you know, hunched over gentleman. And he held his arm out and his wife kind of gingerly took it. And they were making their way very slowly up the steps to where the Torahs are kept. And there was an incredible amount of tenderness between them. And the rabbi then blessed them. And I got all choked up, which was a big deal for me back then, because back then I was not a crier at all. And I just thought to myself, like, what an amazing way to spend my life. And that was my moment. It was really around this idea of deep connection with others, and sharing their journey and blessing it. And that was my moment, and my kind of path has taken me all different ways, but that, I think that still remains at the heart of my brand, this idea of deep relationship building. And, you know, I can talk a little bit too about the specific work that I do, especially with wedding couples, but, this idea of really understanding my relationship with them as a journey, that it's not just officiating on the wedding day itself and checking that officiant box, you know, but that it's much more about understanding who people are and helping them feel completely seen, and that I'm creating something individualized for them that, that speaks to the things that they want to learn more about and the things that they value. So the way that I work with my wedding couples is really kind of an intentional cultivation of their unique relationship and how can I help set them up for success in their marriage. And what does it look like to journey beside someone and give them tools, you know, on their path.
That's so cool. That's a wonderful impetus, you know, as a 21 year old woman.
Yeah.
Sit there and say, this is what I want to do the rest of my life, you know, and sit there and say, okay, I finally understand why I was put here. What was the reason? What do I want to do? How do I want to move forward? And these are the people that I can help. And what I want to dive into is, it's not something to be taken lightly. I mean, whether it's becoming a rabbi or, you know, starting a company or whatever, you know, there's a series of commitments. It's not like you wake up in the morning, decide you're going to become a rabbi, and then the next day you're a rabbi. You know,
that would be nice, though, wouldn't it?
You know, wouldn't it be nice? It's, you know, it is on par with becoming, you know, a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant. There is a long, drawn out process. You know, and it's the commitment that goes along with that. That's the amazing part, because most people don't realize. You know, most rabbis, in fact, you know, every rabbi I know has an undergraduate degree, then they become a rabbi, and then that's just the beginning of the learning process. Most, you know, a lot of rabbis I know have master's degrees, have PhDs, you know, and they tend to be lifelong learners. But so take me through the journey of from the 21-year-old woman to sit there saying, this is what I want to do. What were the next steps? Because, you know, to be able to sit there, because, you know, to go to the yeshiva, to go to the learning institute, to be able to get it, first of all, to be accepted, you know, to be accepted. And then it's what, 3 years, whatever. So take five years. Oh my God, 5 years. So take people through that process, because most people don't understand, you know, the commitment that takes to become a clergy. You know, and the dedication that goes with it.
So Ben, I love that you asked this question, because the truth is, of course, that the story didn't end there with my warm, fuzzy moment, you know, as this couple was blessed on their 58th anniversary. I went back to my rabbi from home. I grew up in the Chicago area, and I told him about this experience, and he said, Jessica, you should become a rabbi. And
so it's his fault.
It's totally Rabbi Bruce Elder's fault. Yeah.
No, if you're listening, it's your fault.
Right. No, what happened was actually so beautiful, and I think so typical. He encouraged me in this path, and I gave him 60 bazillion reasons that I didn't want to do it.
Right.
You know, I said, I don't want to have to deal with synagogue politics, and I don't want to have to write a sermon every week, and, you know, I don't want a job that's 24/7 and all of these things. And truly, I've been able to create a rabbinic path for myself that just feels incredibly aligned, where I have been able to serve in a way that feels very true to myself. But I put up some resistance, and the schooling is intense. We spend our first year in Israel, which is kind of an immersive dive into Hebrew and also kind of basic Jewish studies. And the interesting thing for me, I think, about rabbinical school is it's very much a more of a generalist curriculum. So they're trying to give us kind of a broad swath of a ton of different things that we need to learn about. So it's everything from the Bible to Jewish law, both ancient and more contemporary. So we're learning Talmud, but we're also learning kind of about contemporary theology. And then we're diving into history, and we're diving into, like, you know, older literature, and then contemporary feminist response, you know, the whole thing, educational approaches.
How one responds to the other must be the fascinating.
Oh yeah, the dialogue. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And then we get into, like, homiletics, which is the art of delivering sermons. And we get into, you know, synagogue change. And then I have classes on spiritual guidance. So there's so much variety. And, you know, and interestingly, we're being taught by a real variety of people. You know, we have, like, academics, and then we have people who have been serving kind of more in the field, and we have kind of practical rabbinics, where we have a student internship and we're serving a congregation, and everything in between. And most of what we're being taught is kind of like the background knowledge, so that we have more of a basis of understanding. And then once we get ordained and we're out, you know, serving kind of more in the real world, we're learning a whole nother set of skills, you know, a lot of kind of pastoral education and guiding people who are, you know, journeying through difficult circumstances.
Right.
Or, you know, managing a staff and supervision and things like, so many different pieces. But yeah, it was 5 years, and it was extensive and hard, and thank goodness I felt very clear about my decision, because that helped me stay going when it was a lot.
Right. And let's take it from the theory to the practical, because you touched on that. you know, we all have these people that go through and they get their MBAs or their PhDs or whatever, and then they go out into the world and they've never held a real job before. You know, they might have done a practicum, they might have, you know, done a 6-month internship or something like that, but they've never held a real job. So when you walk out the door and you have your degree in hand and you have all this theoretical knowledge, and then you walk into the door of your first pulpit and somebody dies.
Yeah.
And it happens. You know, I mean, when, I remember a rabbi we had 10 years ago when he first came in, had 6 deaths in the congregation in the first 3 months.
Yeah.
And having to deal with that. And you know, as a young rabbi who's never, you know, really had to deal with this before, how do you deal with that shift from the 5 years of academia to actually having to deal with, as you said, the politics of the congregation and the life and death situations and everything that goes along with it?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. And actually, I think so. I was ordained within the Reform movement, and one of the things that our institution did really well was helping us with pastoral care. And one of the things that they really emphasized, which I found to be incredibly true for both me as a rabbi, but moreover me as a friend and someone who, you know, cares about others and has a large community in my life, is that when people are going through tragedy or through hard times, the most beautiful thing we can do is just show up and say, I am here. Mm-hmm. The power of really just seeing someone else exactly where they are without needing them to be okay, without needing to change them, you know, our presence. And without needing to offer explanations for why something is happening. I think one of the, you know, so many of us feel discomfort with pain because it is hard and it's scary and it's unsettling and it hurts, is not to need to explain it away or take it away, but just saying, I am here. Like, all I want to do is hold your hand and sit by your side and, you know, bring you a snack if you want that or not. But really, you know, the power of true presence. And I think, you know, for your listeners too, like we know the power of this in terms of how we serve our communities and our clients, right? There's truly nothing more powerful than being seen and feeling like someone is so deeply present with you. So I think, you know, I think for me, like when something awful has happened, and especially something unexpected, and people can often, they want to know why, right? And they want to know answers because it hurts and it doesn't make sense. And the answers to that question that have been the most powerful for me have been, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's our place to know as humans. I mean, I think that there are forces that are much bigger than us at play that we can find meaning in, and we can, and we certainly can connect to the outpouring of love and connection, perhaps that comes from tragedy. But I think, you know, comments like, you know, there's a reason this happened, or it's all for the best, or things like that can be incredibly hurtful to people. And so just learning to sit with someone in pain is a very powerful gift to give to them. And I was just going to say, even though it feels like we wish we could be doing more because we feel helpless and we feel for them, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, and that tends to be more of a tenet of leadership than of clergy in the thing, because whether it's a congregant or whether it's an employee or whether it's a great client, you know, sometimes you just need to be there to listen.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, maybe it's, they just need somebody who can just sit there and listen to them and just help them work through the problem by just being there for them and just sit there saying, okay, and what do you mean by that? And, you know, how does that make you feel? And, you know, and what's the direction you want to go? And the more that we as leaders can be there for the people around us, I think the world becomes a better place. I truly do.
Yeah, 100%. And I think what you're speaking to is the idea of not putting our own story of what we think they should do or feel on them. And it applies in every single area, right? It's not,
absolutely.
It's in business, it's in our, you know, relationships of all kinds. And I think, you know, the way that I approach the wedding couples I serve is the same thing. Like I ask them, you know, what is your vision of your dream wedding? Or what is your vision of your relationship with your officiant? And then I get to, hear from them, like, how do we want to feel? Instead of me saying, here's what I think you need. Mm-hmm. Because there's actually so much beauty and power in serving someone from their kind of individual heart space than like putting our own story or formula on it. And I certainly have guidelines. I have kind of categories that I'd like to be able to touch on with each couple, but it's so fun to create something that's individualized and personalize it. Like that's where the, you know, that's where the creativity comes in.
Oh, yeah. It's enabling people to succeed on their own space.
Yes.
You know, on their own terms, because we all have our own vision about what we would like to see our future be,
right.
You know, or what, you know, what success looks like in a particular place. And the more we as people can understand other people's points of view, their points of reference, what's important to them, it's so much easier for us to help them get there.
100%. And, you know, along those lines, asking what would be of most value to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes and yes.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a skill that I think that a lot of people miss. A lot of people have their own interpretation of how things should be. You know, this is how I believe parenting should be. And that's an absolute. I believe that, you know, this is how this situation should go out. And that's an absolute because this is what I think. So obviously everybody else thinks the same way. You know, there's 7.5 billion people in the world. All thought the same way. How boring would that world be?
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. And of course they're the Jewish jokes, you know, like 2 Jews, 17 bazillion opinions. So
absolutely.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, we each have so many different sides to ourselves. So providing space to explore all of those is it's a beautiful gift that we can give people.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and let's talk about being a rabbi as a woman, because, you know, first of all, there are no Orthodox, you know, female rabbis. It's just, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
In the conservative movement, 5%, 8%, maybe, you know, it's a very small number if it's not high at all.
Yeah.
But in the Reform movement, obviously it's far more accepted and it's far more, you know, I have no idea what the numbers are, but, you know, take a look at it as the world has changed and, you know, and as clergy has become more acceptable for there to be women, you know, and a variety of different types of people, you know, how has that, you know, how has your life changed because of that eventuality? The fact that, you know, first of all, there is a place for you within the rabbinate and, you know, and how does it help you change the viewpoints of the Reform movement as a female rabbi, because, you know, you come to the world with a different point of view and a different, you know, a different set of beliefs and thoughts and ideas. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it needs to be celebrated, but how is that changing the movement and how is that changing the direction of the Reform movement?
I love that you asked this question. I was not expecting it and I'm so happy to dive in. So I think, as I mentioned, I was ordained within the Reform movement, which is one of the more progressive American denominations. And now graduating classes there's a higher percentage of women than men. So things really are shifting. And I have been active in the Women's Rabbinic Network, which is the Reform female rabbi organization. And you know, we've come so far. The first female American rabbi was ordained in 73. That was Sally Priesand. And
1973. So we're talking less than 40 years or 45 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we've come a long way. There have been many female rabbis who really paved the way for my generation. And there's still such a long way to go. Like, pay equity is still an incredibly hot issue for us, and it's not equal yet. Microaggressions, you know, I get comments all the time, Ben, like, you're too pretty to be a rabbi, you know, like stuff that's just so incredibly, it's superficial.
I've never even thought of that, you know.
Yeah, all the time. Or you're too young, you know, like just comments about our appearance and you know, things that have nothing to do with hopefully our spiritual leadership.
Right. Or your ability to lead a congregation. Exactly.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. So we have come a long way. There's still kind of a lot of activism to be done. And there are a lot of amazing leaders out there who are kind of on the ground continuing to fight for change. I think one of the beautiful things, and I saw this as I served my congregation, but also with my couples now, for young kids, both boys and girls, like think of, you know, kindergartners or first graders, for their rabbi to be a woman and for that to be just the norm for them is incredibly powerful. So that's, I think, a beautiful change that female clergy are bringing to their communities. I was very lucky. My congregation was so respectful and embracing of me, and I felt incredibly empowered in my rabbinate. And even though I was young when I started, I was 29 when I started there, I still felt tremendous respect, which sadly I think is not the norm, you know.
Right.
I think it's not the norm.
And 29, to get this right, 29 for a rabbi, whether you're male or female, is young.
It's young.
I mean, you're dealing with, you know, people that could be in their 60s, 70s, 80s, in our congregation into their 90s, you know, with different viewpoints. So the ageism, forget about the fact that you're a woman, but the fact that you're just young, you right. know, a lot of people say, well, how do we relate to somebody that's half our age that could be the same age as some of our kids?
For sure. And I, you know, I give my congregation a tremendous amount of credit that they offered, you know, the belief and respect in me. And you know, we each have different gifts that come with age. So like, you know, I was able to relate to younger congregants in a way that, you know, a rabbi in his 70s probably wouldn't. And that was an asset that I brought.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I'm such a feminist, and I think moving through the world as a female rabbi, like people have a lot of their own, you know, transference that they put on you about, you know, the role of women, about what rabbis are supposed to look like, and everything in between. So, yeah, I mean, I've had for the most part, like really wonderful experiences. And I think too, like, there's an approachability that is really important to me. Like I want to serve from a place of authenticity so that, you know, the people with whom I'm connecting feel that too. And they feel like they can be themselves. So, you know, as we move into a world that's just a little bit more, it's less hierarchical and a little bit more intimate, I think being able to harness that has been powerful and helpful.
Right. And you said something earlier about, you know, the next generation, the kids that are 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Yeah.
For them to be able to look at somebody and sit there and say, oh, that's my rabbi. Not that's my male rabbi, not my female rabbi, not my gay rabbi, not my straight rabbi, not my black rabbi, not my Chinese rabbi, not my white rabbi, but my rabbi.
Yeah.
It's kind of a neat thing to be able to sit there and say, and we need to be moving towards that, whether it's within the clergy, whether it be at work, whether it be, you know, politics or whatever, to be able to move people to the thought process is we're people.
Yeah.
You know,
amen.
There are good people. There are bad people. There are people you like. There's people you don't like. But in the end, they're people. And the more we can look at people as human beings and sit there and say, okay, you know, I dislike them because of the viewpoint that they put forward, or the content of their character. that's fine, as right. long as you can back that up. But you like them because of the content of their character, or the moral fiber, or the abilities that they have, and not because they're black, they're white, they're male, they're female, they're gay, they're straight, they're whatever. You yeah. know, I think that's the world we need to move in, and whether it's, you know, clergy or work or wherever, and be able to sit there and say, we need to have the right people in the right places at the right time to be able to lead. And that's the world that we need to work towards.
100%. Yes. And also to interrogate our own biases. We each have our own stories that we put on people and situations. And so to continue to push ourselves towards growth in those areas as well. Labels are narrow.
So. Yes, they are. So you spent, before you are where you are now in Denver, you spent 8 years in Seattle as a first-time rabbi.
Yeah.
What were the things, because, you know, when we go back to the beginning of this conversation, you were talking to your rabbi about whether, you know, you were putting all the things about the things that you didn't want to be.
Right.
You came out of, you know, out of your clergy school and became an ordained rabbi and went into probably a very traditional type synagogue. I mean, it was a Reform synagogue, but it was, you know, you were into the tenets of, you know, phone calls that could come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, a staff that you had to, you know, you had to deal with, the politics of the synagogue, all that kind of things. So what made you decide to do that right away when you realized that those were things that you disliked to do? And what took you beyond that?
When you say what took me beyond that, you mean like what helped me move through kind of that, my own resistance? Is that what you're asking?
First of all, move back through your own resistance into the place where you are now, where you, as far as I know, you don't have a congregation anymore. You do,
right.
You know, you're doing the type of, you know, officiating the type of work that you want to do, the retreats and the weddings and all those type of things, to sit there and say, okay, I've been a pulpit rabbi, I've been a pulpit, you know, clergy. Yeah. I've been there. I've done that. That's not what I want to do. Okay, now I've got that in my head. Now it's time to do these, you know, this is the direction that I want to go to. Because, you know, it's almost like going from being an employee to being self-employed.
100%. Yeah,
you've gone from that employee model to that entrepreneurial model. So it's, you know, it's what took you through that journey and what gave you that impetus to move to the next direction?
Yeah, I love this question. So my first job out of school was actually as a Hillel rabbi at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So that's like the Jewish student organization on college campuses. And my biggest lesson there, I think, was about when you show up to a new job, the importance of proving your worth. I think I was hesitant to kind of like jump in and share big ideas because I was new and I was just tentative.
Sure.
And so that was a really big, important lesson. Like, I need to prove that I'm adding value here. And that was my first job. And then my synagogue was really wonderful. I was there 8.5 years. I really came into my own there. And I think that if I wanted to stay a congregational rabbi, I would never have left. Your question is so, so beautiful, because I think that one of the biggest gifts that serving a congregation gave me was that I was around the fragility of life so constantly. I was around death. I was around illness. I was, you know, deeply embedded in how fragile we are as human beings. Also how strong we are, for sure. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot that we don't have control over in our lives. And I saw that again and again. And that knowledge, you know, didn't propel me into a place of fear. It did the opposite. It made me feel so deeply that we get this one spin on this planet as the soul that is uniquely us, and we better be living the life that we want to be living. And that is really what drives my soul and my being. And so once I kind of realized that I was feeling burnt out at this job, and that as much as I loved them and they loved me, I was really ready for a new adventure. Like, I was just ready. I was ready. I was in Seattle. The weather was hard for me. wanted to be somewhere with more sun.
The Pacific Northwest, you know what? If you want to live, you know, if you want it to be green, you'd have to let a little rain fall. That's the
way it is. It's true. It's so true. And it is true that there's always sun above, you know, the rain clouds. That is also true. But I was ready for a change. And you know, this knowledge that, like, I am the one in charge of creating my life. And if my soul is calling me for change, then I better listen to her. And I really had a moment towards the end of my time there when I had a voice that came to me that said, "You can't stay." And I was out on a bike ride. I'm a huge cyclist. And it came at the beginning of my bike ride. And I heard this voice. And it was one of those voices kind of like from within and from without, you know, like, is this in my own head or not? And I heard it and I started to cry because I knew the weight of it. I knew the truth of it. And I sat with it for a long time because I didn't want to make this decision hastily. But I knew that I wanted to be my own boss and I wanted to be in control over my time. And I was, you know, ready for a change. And that's what brought me to Denver. And I bring that teaching, I think, to those I serve. Like, we get to create the life that we want for ourselves. And it's one that can be filled with joy and abundance and authenticity and vulnerability and wisdom. But we, you know, I do believe in living big and creating the life we want. And it's really what drives me. Yeah.
Perfect. I love it. Mentors.
Oh my God.
Have a mentor and do you believe in mentorship?
Oh, yes. Yes. I have mentors in the field. I have people, like, I just ran into someone about a week ago who is doing work that I, like, you know, kind of next stages for me in my business. And I do feel like I'm going to get a little bit spiritual on you, but not too much. So I feel like when we come across people where there's a spark of like, oh yes, or this, you know, like to listen to that and to honor it and to follow it. So I'm a huge, huge podcast person. It's one of the like main ways that I kind of tap into my own spirit and use for my own personal growth. So Elizabeth Gilbert is my number one fairy godmother. I think she's someone who really embodies, you know, playfulness and wisdom and authenticity and vulnerability and living really big. And tenderness too. She's one that I love. I listen to Chase Jarvis's podcast a lot. I listen to relationship podcasts a lot, but I have, you know, I have mentors within my rabbinic work. I have, you know, now that I'm moving into spiritual entrepreneurship, I think I've actually fully moved into that. I have people in the business world who I turn to. So yes, I think that, you know, to have a tribe is one of the most beautiful gifts that we can give ourselves, and we do not need to figure it out alone.
Nice. So two more things. One, I know you have an offer for our audience, and how do they get in touch with you?
Yes, perfect. Perfect. So, you know, we haven't talked a ton about my work with wedding couples, which is great because people can kind of continue to dive in after our podcast concludes today. My website is up there. It's rabbijessicamarshall.com. Once this podcast airs, if you want to post and tag it, we would love it. You know, we'd love that. And if you referrals are really the heart of my business. So if you know couples who are getting married or thinking about getting married, I'm delighted to offer a $50 Amazon gift card for referrals for weddings that I do, and then also for the couples themselves. So it's a generous offer that I'm delighted to do. And just, you know, for people who have, you know, questions about the wedding process, ways to personalize it, even if you already have an officiant, but there are things about kind of continuing your growth as a couple that feel appealing, I'm delighted to connect with you.
Perfect. And use the tag yourlivingbrand.liveshow, and that'll get you the coupon. So when you're contacting Rabbi Jessica, you know, use the yourlivingbrand.liveshow tag, and you know, that'll make sure you get get your $50 gift card. That way we keep it organized. The last thing I'm going to do, and then we're going to let you go.
Yeah.
When you walk out the door, when you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
Oh, such a good question. There's a Maya Angelou quote that says, people will not remember what you said. People will not remember what you did. They'll remember how you made them feel. And that is what is most important to me. The way that I serve people is through connection. It's through relationship. It's through them feeling truly seen, them knowing that I care about them as individuals, that there's really a deeper commitment to walking by someone's side as we kind of journey on this wedding path. And that hopefully they feel all of the heart and wholeheartedness that I bring to that. And that's what's most important to me.
Love it. Jessica, thank you very much for being an absolutely wonderful guest. I loved having you on the show. You were the perfect guest for 9/11. You know, this is the 18th anniversary of 9/11, and 18 in the Judaism is chai, which is the meaning for life. You know, so I think that we have an absolute phenomenal thing together. Thank you for being here, and thanks for being a great guest.
Thank you, Ben. I so appreciate it.
All right, take care. This is Ben Baker of the You're Living Brand Live show on K4HD Radio. We'll be right back.
The Your Living Brand Show is brought to you by Your Brand Marketing. Did you know that the world views your brand not as you desire, but as it relates to them? That's why you need to communicate your brand. Tell a story. Win loyalty. Your Brand Marketing helps you reach that goal. It's time to stop being a commodity and instead be a brand worth loving. It's time to contact Your Brand Marketing. Please visit www.powerfulpersonalbrands.com. Download a free chapter of the book on personal branding. That's www.powerfulpersonalbrands.com. Download your free copy now.
Welcome back to K4HD Radio. This is Ben Baker, and this is the Your Living Brand Live Show. I want to thank Jessica for being on the show today. She was a phenomenal guest, and she taught us some really valuable lessons about entrepreneurship. We all need to understand, what is our true calling? What are the things we do well, and who do we do them for? Who is our real audience? How can we best serve them, and how can we add value? She realized that being a pulpit rabbi was not what she wanted to do, and it kept her from doing the things that she really, truly valued. So she built a business that took care of her clients in a way that added value, had meaning, and gave the people that she deals with something special and a reason for them to talk about her. And that's a goal of any entrepreneur, to find out, who do I serve? How do I serve them? Why do they care about me? And how can I make their lives better? Because if you can do that, people will talk about you, and they'll want to be with you, and they'll want to promote you to others. Now, I want to say thank you to everybody on this show. I have decided that from now until the end of the year, I am going to pre-record my episodes. I have just realized that, you know what? I am not able to be here and to be able to help every single person at Wednesday at 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm traveling too much, but I still want to serve. I still want to be there, and I want to be there for you, and I want to add value. But the way I'm going to be able to do that is to pre-record my episodes and be able to have them for you both here on the radio and also on iHeart, on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and your browser of choice. So thank you for being a wonderful audience. And we're going to try this experiment, and we'll see how it goes. And if you want me, you can always get in touch with me at the YourLivingBrand.live show site. Go there, click on me and, you know, send me a message. I'd love to hear from you. Love to answer your questions and find out how I can help you. This has been Ben Baker. This is the Your Living Brand.live show. Have an absolutely wonderful week, everybody. And we will talk soon. This has been the Your Living Brand.live show. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. My name is Ben Baker and my company is Your Brand Marketing. We help you to stop being a commodity and instead be a brand worth loving. If you want to communicate more effectively and build influence through trust, contact us at yourbrandmarketing.com. That's www.yourbrandmarketing.com. But every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, this is the Your Living Brand.live show. Tune in next week on K4HD Radio when we ask another guest, what's your story?